This is a show about peace, preserving it, promoting it, and monitoring those who would seek to destroy it. I'm Verna Avery Brown. If the Bush administration exercises the authority to wage war against Saddam Hussein and topples the leader of Iraq, who will rule in his place? An article leaked today to the New York Times outlines a detailed plan that would install an American-led military government in Iraq. Chris Tensing, editor of the Middle East Report, says such a plan would place the U.S. alongside France and Britain in colonizing other countries.
It's nothing less than a reprise of classic British and French colonialism, if this is in fact what the Bush administration has in mind. This is exactly how the British and French did things in the wake of World War I. They took out the existing governmental structures and imposed their own. There was something called the colonial mandate, which was supposed to be that the idea was that Britain and France were holding Middle Eastern countries in trust until such time as their populations could be trusted with self-governance. And that appears to be exactly what the administration is proposing to do in a post-Saddam Iraq. It's quite remarkable, given what we know about the legacy of divisiveness and bloodshed and social fragmentation that British and French colonialism left in the Middle East, and we're still contending with it to this day.
So I guess we'll have to add American colonialism
to that list. If this plan goes ahead, then that we will have to add that to the list.
The president has stated quite openly that regime change is part of the mission in Iraq, although heretofore I think it had been unclear as to how that changing of the Saddam Hussein regime would actually take place. But with reports apparently leaked to the New York Times, an American general has been named to perhaps assume position as head of Iraq.
Right. And there's a couple of interesting things here. One of them is, as I said, the sheer hubris of this idea. And the second thing is that it appears that the administration planners are now sidelining the Iraqi opposition, which had previously been apparently very close to the decision-making circles in the administration. The Iraqi National Congress, the alleged umbrella organization for the Iraqi opposition that's based in London, has been lobbying vociferously for the last several years to have the United States go in militarily and take out the regime. And their proponents in Washington have been centered among some GOP backbenchers in Congress, but also among some of the people who are currently the second-tier people in the Defense Department and the Vice President's office, Paul Wolfowitz, people in the Vice President's office like Louis Libby. And these guys have long been proponents of the INC over the very vocal objections of the State Department, the CIA, and other agencies with expertise in foreign affairs. So in a rather ironic twist here, it seems that the preferred candidate of the hawks who have been pushing the war forward in the Vice President's office in the Defense Department have now been sidelined in favor of an approach that is being pushed by the military. And I suppose, a reversal of fortune for the Iraqi opposition, it would appear.
How credible is this report, though? I mean, White House spokesman Ari Fleischer is reportedly denying it, and the article doesn't actually name any officials by name.
Right, and that leads one to think that, as I stated earlier, it's possible that anything is possible with leaks in Washington. One thing that's possible is that this is a real idea and that it's being floated as a trial balloon to see if it will spark any outrage. And if it does, then they'll drop it. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that this is disinformation, which they're potentially putting out as a way of rattling Saddam's cage, making him nervous, trying to provoke him into some irrational act, which would build international consensus for a military action, something like that, which might spark a coup attempt, something like that. That's possible. A third possibility is that the officials who leaked these plans to the Times are trying to expose them to the public, and that they're dissatisfied with them or think they're find them scary, and they're trying to embarrass the administration into pulling back from ideas like this. That's also possible. And the fourth possibility is that they are in fact real and do represent a consensus in the administration. And it's not really possible to know right now what in fact is the case. The fact that R.A. Fleischer is denying them certainly indicates that there's either some embarrassment in the White House about this or just a lack of consensus in the White House about this. And it may be that that this is just another salvo in some ongoing intra-administration debates about what the shape of a post-war Iraq should be.
Chris Tensing is editor of the Middle East Report. The founder of Black Voices for Peace, Damu Smith, is concerned that far more African Americans need to become involved in the anti-war movement. He dropped by our studios here in Washington and spoke of how foreign policy issues eventually hit home.
Well, you know, Verna, I remember Charles Allen, who was a family friend, and during the Vietnam War, I saw him lying in a coffin in his Marine uniform, and he was the fiancé of a friend of ours at church. And it was at that time, in 1966, that I realized that while the Vietnam War was taking place 10,000 miles away, it hit right back home in St. Louis, Missouri, where I grew up, with the death of Charles Allen, a family friend who was killed during the tour of duty in Vietnam. All that to say this, African Americans are disproportionately represented in the nation's armed forces. We are particularly overrepresented in the infantry parts of the military services. So, you know, we man the artillery, we do the grunt work, that kind of thing. So any war fought in the deserts of the Middle East will be fought with black soldiers and Latino soldiers and Native American soldiers serving disproportionately and therefore dying disproportionately, potentially, in this conflict.
Is that the type of war that we would be headed for, though, in this particular instance? We know where the Persian Gulf War was basically sort of a video game, it seemed, because there was not actually combat troops engaging.
Well, if they're talking about regime change and the administration has really not changed that policy, there's the likelihood that they would have to go into Baghdad and fight to take over the country and take over the government. And that means that they're going to have to do battle in the streets of Baghdad. They may not want to do that, but eventually, if they're talking about regime change, mm-hmm. unless they're counting on an internal force to organize a coup, we're going to be talking about ground forces going in. And so I think that it's important for the nation to understand that African Americans have a very unique stake in all of this, not only because we may die disproportionately in this war, but as Dr. Martin Luther King said many years ago when he criticized U.S. involvement in Vietnam, the bombs that explode in Vietnam explode at home. They explode in the ghettos of Watts and Harlem and other places. And how do they explode? The trillions of dollars being spent on war and war preparations is money that cannot be spent on the nation's economic priorities and human needs priorities. That means that housing, affordable housing, health care, job generation, economic development, all of those kinds of things cannot be funded at adequate levels if we're spending all this money on the military. We are already marginalized.
Yes, and I hear the callers into the morning talk shows oftentimes saying, you know, the war is important, but, you know, I really want to talk about some issues, you know, closer to home, like health care and jobs, and it's as if they're not really connecting the dots.
No, and that's where leadership comes in. That's why we formed Black Voices for Peace, because we feel that we have to educate our community and the public at large about this connection. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that money spent on one thing cannot be spent on another. If you're spending trillions of dollars to prepare for war, making bombs, missiles, tanks, planes, high-tech wizardry to kill people, you can't spend that on affordable housing and job generation. So we as a community have to understand, as an already marginalized community, how this will further dig deeper into services and resources that could be available to us. And another point I want to make is that oil prices have already gone up as a result of the war talk.
Hmm.
Who's paying for that? We drive cars. We pay home heating bills.
Mm-hmm.
That's coming out of our pockets. We have to understand the relationship between all of these things and understand that we died in the Twin Towers like other people did. We had three black D.C. school teachers who died on that plane that crashed into the Pentagon. We had black people who died at the Pentagon. We had a black pilot piloting that plane in Pennsylvania. We have an immediate stake in this. We had black soldiers who died on the USS Cole when it was attacked in Yemen. Black Marines died in Lebanon in 1982. We have a direct stake in this. This is not a distant issue for our community. And we've got to mobilize against this war.
Damu Smith, founder of Black Voices for Peace, the organization is holding a mass rally in front of the White House on Saturday. Students in an ad hoc coalition of groups opposed to U.S. aggression against Iraq gathered this week in a Rice University campus chapel in Houston, Texas. A simple no-war poster hung from the altar at the front of the chapel as professors, alumni, students, and local peace and justice activists spoke from the pulpit, advocating both awareness and action. We have this report prepared by Renee Feltz.
I want to speak about why we're going to war, why we shouldn't go to war, and about confronting war makers. Are there other ways to find peace with Iraq? Were there alternatives to bombing civilians in Afghanistan? Why must we always claim to seek peace through war? Martin Luther King Jr. said that wars are poor chisels for carving out peaceful tomorrows. Iraq contains the second largest reserves of oil in the world. Halliburton, the corporation from which Dick Cheney retired to become vice president, is positioning itself to get access to the oil and gas fields in Uzbekistan through the Central Asia Oil Pipeline, made now possible that Afghanistan is open to U.S. corporations. Two wars, two new oil markets.
Rice alum and local musician Nick Cooper challenged those in the audience to familiarize themselves with the history of a close-to-home war maker, James Baker. Baker was Secretary of State under George Bush during the 1991 Gulf War, and is a strong presence on campus through his involvement in the James Baker Institute for Policy Studies.
James Baker is the senior partner at the law firm Baker Botts, which claims to be the leading international law firm involved in the reemergence of oil, gas, and related hydrocarbon transportation industries in the Caspian region. The Caspian Sea is pretty much right between Afghanistan and Iraq, just north of Iran. Baker Botts also represented Enron. James Baker also was the spokesperson for the Bush administration in its successful attempt to halt the vote recount in Florida. James Baker is also the counsel for intelligence policy. His job is preparing all applications for electronic surveillance and physical search under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and advising the CIA, the FBI, and the Defense and State Departments. As Secretary of State under Bush's father, Baker was also, in my opinion, guilty of international war crimes, violating the Geneva Convention by destroying the civilian infrastructure of Iraq. It is convenient for him that the Bush administration has successfully pressured Europe to agree to exempt U.S. citizens from the International War Crimes Tribunal.
A member of the Houston chapter of Pax Christi voiced his concern that more war crimes are on the way.
I think the rain today is like teardrops. Nature is crying before we enter into another horrible war. Our political leaders, rather than learning from 9/11 and working to achieve peace in the world, are using 9/11 and the fear that that event engenders in the American people to take us down the path to war. This is just plain wrong. A preemptive war with Iraq will likely result in the death of thousands and tens of thousands of innocent people, mostly the Iraqi people. Because the way we conduct war these days, we do everything possible to protect our own troops. We drop these bombs from thousands of feet, and not very many of our men and women will die. But we'll just absolutely bomb the hell out of Iraq, including Baghdad, and we'll kill thousands and tens of thousands of Iraqi people. You know, if you're working to achieve world domination, any nation is up for grab by the imperial powers, particularly if you have natural resources that they wish to control. So what must we do? I believe that we have to resist, even if that means civil disobedience.
Not all students passing by the chapel were convinced Bush should not attack Iraq.
So we're talking about going in and deposing a ruler. You think that that's something that is part of our constitutional mandate?
I think the United States has a right to do whatever is in its power to protect its national interests. If that means deposing Saddam Hussein, as far as regime change, yeah, I think the United States has a perfect right to do that.
Help, America, this is quite serious. America, this is the impression I get from looking in the television set. America, is this correct? I better get right down to the job. It's true, I don't want to join the Army or turn lathes and precision part factories. I'm nearsighted and psychopathic anyway. America, I'm putting my queer shoulder to the wheel. So I said, I've taught that poem many times, and it's had its particular significance in the last several weeks as I witness what's been happening in the media and in our own lives. If anybody studies U.S. foreign policy, you kind of get a sense that this is a hegemonic country. It's run by an oligarchy of people who have interests that are quite different from ours.
University of Houston history professor Bob Bozanko's reading of Allen Ginsberg's poem, America, encapsulated the frustration felt by many in previous decades of U.S. warmongering.
I've also been thinking a lot about somebody else, Mario Savio. In 1964, he was a young graduate student in Berkeley and spontaneously stood on top of a police car and made a speech at Sproul Hall, which ignited what would become known as the free speech movement. And whereas Ginsberg is talking about what America means to him and trying to reclaim what America should be, Savio has a different approach. Mario Savio said, there's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Bozanko's recollection of debates on college campuses during past anti-war movements didn't convince this student passing by the demonstration.
I don't have a problem with people, you know, having an opposition to the war and debating the war. That's all well and good, and that needs to be done to get a rational solution. But for people to come out and have the opinion that I'm against war at all times for any reason, it's ludicrous. I mean, do they really honestly believe that the United States sat back and just said, okay, attack us and we'll do nothing, that the United States would last very long? They seem to think that if we sat back and did nothing, the attacks would somehow stop on their own. And that's just naive.
Associate Professor of Sociology Elizabeth Long acknowledged the need for concern about possible security threats to the United States, but joined with others at the demonstration in asking if war is the answer to the country's security problems.
They are evil people. We need to do something to protect ourselves. The rhetoric links this war with things I think many Americans would like to see, but I don't see any evidence that that link actually exists. We need to work very hard to eliminate the ground on which terrorists stand, and moving against Iraq does not seem to me to deal with that. In fact, moving towards war doesn't seem to deal with that at all. It seems to me to be a much longer and harder process of addressing global inequities, of attempting to work for human rights, of helping people find ways of surviving in the world that have dignity. That doesn't mean war. That means peace.
Renee Feltz prepared that report. While the Bush administration seems poised to send military service members back into Iraq, some Gulf War veterans don't want the nation to forget what happened to them during the first Gulf War in 1991. From Pacifica's KPFK in Los Angeles, Beneath the Surface host Jerry Quickly was able to have a veterans representative ask some tough questions about the Defense Department.
My name's Jerry Quickly, and this is Beneath the Surface. My two guests on the show today are Joyce Riley, who's been a registered nurse for over 30 years, and she's also served on U.S. Air Force Reserve and as a spokesperson for the American Association of Gulf War Veterans. And also joining us is Dr. Michael Kilpatrick. He's a Deputy Director for Deployment Health Support Directorate at the Department of Defense. And I'd like to ask, because she is a much more skilled, a much more adept, and there's a huge background in this, rather than have me ask questions, I certainly would like to have Joyce have ask any questions you might have for Dr. Kilpatrick.
Thank you very much, Jerry. Let me ask you, Dr. Kilpatrick, would you agree that the United States government has experimented upon its military over the past 50 years without their consent?
And again, I think that it is very important to be able to put your question into the proper context. And when you say experimentation, certainly we have conducted research. We have done testing of chemical and biological agents and simulants to understand vulnerability of weapon systems and theater. But as far as using the Gulf War veterans or using any people in uniform in the form of guinea pigs, as I've heard people talk about.
Okay, let me refresh your memory. Correct. Senate Report 103-97 says, during the past 50 years, hundreds of thousands of military personnel have been involved in human experimentation and other intentional exposures conducted by the Department of Defense without the service members' knowledge or consent. That is a government document. Let me move on then. You're familiar with the Regal Interim Report, in which it says that the rate of illnesses among Gulf War veterans was as high as 77% in one unit. Do you recall that?
That's correct.
Okay, and do you recall that there was a statement made by Shelley Kashvili and John Deutsch that said there is no information, classified or unclassified, that indicates that chemical or biological weapons were used in the Persian Gulf?
And that was a belief at that point in time, which we subsequently have been able to show was not correct, that there were no weapons used in an offensive manner. There was exposure to chemical weapons when U.S. troops were blowing up munitions at a site called Kamacia.
Well, I think your troops differ with you on that. We've got signed affidavits from those that say there were offensive weapons used there in the Persian Gulf, that there were 15,000 chemical alarms that went off during that time. We also had suits that were not properly fitted that were defective. Is that correct, in a large percentage of the chemical suits?
And again, those are data that have come to light as far as a company that is obviously bankrupt that made defective suits.
Okay, and then Senate Report 103-900 says that the probability of chemical and biological exposures was that there was the probability of chemical and biological exposures that was known in 1994. The statement also was there, the Gulf War veterans are not just sick, they're dying, and also that the disease was communicable. Were you aware of that in Senate Report 103-900?
And again, those reports are relying on data that are being provided by different researchers or investigators and have not really been able to be confirmed by places like the Center for Disease Control.
Well, let's put it this way. All the studies that show that there's nothing wrong with the Gulf War veteran are paid for by government dollars. All of the independent studies that are now being done are showing that there are problems with Gulf War veterans, including those done at Southwestern University in Dallas. So the government has not been able to find anything wrong, even though we now know that the United States knowingly sold these weapons to Iraq, and also the UNSCOM report in 1995 said that, and I quote the UNSCOM report, "It's reasonable to assume that given that biological weapons were considered as strategic weapons, they were actually deployed." That's a 1995 report. Are you familiar with that?
And it's very clear that they were deployed because we have found the chemical weapons deployed to Kamacia.
And are you aware of the fact that
used.
The United States provided many of those weapons?
And again, I think that you are going beyond providing some of the basic ingredients. And if we talk about the biologicals, those were, as you as a nurse well know, that hospitals use biological agents to identify isolates from patients. And
sir, let me remind you that in the UNSCOM report,
it says,
however, the media imported by Iraq was in 25 to 100 kilogram drums, the style of packaging consistent with large-scale usage of media associated with the production of biological agents. Normal media was provided in 0.1 kilogram packages. This was in 25 to 100 kilogram drums. I think that we can know that was not used for research purposes. So I think that, you know, and one other question I wanted to ask you is, was the AIDS vaccine or a variant of the anti-AIDS vaccine, AIDS vaccine usage during the Gulf War on Gulf War veterans?
No, it was not.
You know,
Dr. O'Donnell has already admitted that they were used, sir.
I beg to differ. Dr. O'Donnell and I worked very closely together.
I have that on tape, and I'll be glad to provide that to you.
In the Gulf War.
Special thanks to KPFK host Jerry Quickly and producer Christine Blasdale for that segment.
Bravo 2-5, this is Bravo 2-6, over. Bravo 25. This is Bravo 26. Over. America is still in love with the Wild West show. George Custer, George Patton, George Bush. Men with guns are on the move. And the black marble wall of name goes up to the sun. Sammy's touch button future in the deserts of Arabia. Bravo 25, this is Bravo 26, over. Bravo 25, do you read me, over? Bravo 25, Bravo 25, do you read me, over? George Bush, I salute you. Saddam Hussein, I salute you. All pilots, co-pilots, navigators, bombardiers, I salute you. All generals giving orders, I salute you. All colonels, majors, captains, lieutenants, sergeants giving orders, I salute you. All grunts following out orders, I salute you. All tank commanders, track commanders. All medevac and MASH units, I salute you. All scud launchers, all chemical warfare teams, all Marines, all Republican guards, I salute you. I salute you. I salute the defense workers in the bomb assembly, and all you mothers naming your sons Saddam, all you mothers naming your sons George, I salute you. All senators, representatives, flag salesmen, headstone carvers, I salute you. Little boy at the war rally, in your combat fatigue, with your flag and toy gun, I salute you. I salute your parents, your future. I salute the clarity at the knot of my sorrow. I salute the clarity at the root of this war. The new world order, I salute you. The holes in my legs salute you. My nights of terror and sweat salute you. All you who support the war, my heart like a sieve salutes you. The dead and the dying salute you. Flight 19, this is flight leader, over. Roger, flight leader. Flight 19, do we have a mission, over? That's an affirmative, flight leader. Flight 19, this is flight leader. Roger that, affirmative. It's a mission. Let's head for home.
Listening to Imperatives for Peace, Pacifica's Peace Watch. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Tonight's engineer was Granger Helvey. Our editor is Reem Kahuta at WPFW. Our associate producers are Fidel Rodriguez at KPFK, Renee Feltz of KPFT, and Robert Knight of WBAI. Sam Husseini and Larry Binsky are consultants to this program. We had production assistance from Sidrak Franklin and Laurel Padgett-Seekins at WPFW, Christopher Sprinkle at KPFK, David Russo of the DC Indie Media Center. Our webmaster is Pete Caracas. For copies of Peace Watch, go to www.pacificaarchives.org or call 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your feedback on the show. Send us your comments to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.